On every tree there sits a bird, singing a song of love. On every tree there sits a bird, and everyone I ever heard could break my heart without a word, singing a song of love. A song of love is a sad song, hi-lily, hi-lily, hi-lo. A song of love is a song of war, don't ask me how I know.
Leslie Caron was an innocent-looking ingenue with a cute French accent when she stole the hearts of American moviegoers, playing an orphan who creates a circus act by talking with puppets in the 1953 film Lily. In her new memoir called Thank Heaven, Leslie Caron tells her life story and reveals what it was like to work with Gene Kelly, Fred Astaire, Cary Grant, and many of the other stars of MGM's Golden Age. She'd been trained in ballet before she moved to Hollywood at the age of 17 and has since appeared in 45 films, including An American in Paris, her first, Gigi, Daddy Longlegs, The L-Shaped Room, Chocolat. Her book is published by Viking. We're delighted that it brings Leslie Caron to our show today. Hello.
Well, hello.
When you were young, you lived in your grandparents' mansion outside of Paris, and you described parties hosted by your grandparents where all the family would dress up as Greek gods and goddesses. Where did that tradition come from? Where did the tradition come from?
Oh, no, no, no.
Was that something that just your family came up with?
By the time I came along, the parties were not in costume anymore, but I have pictures of them, and there are some, there's one in the book, where a Venice party, because they had a little chateau near the river, the Seine, and they had a little temple on the Seine, and they did give costume parties.
It sounds very Isadora Duncan.
They were, as people of that day, around turn of the century, they lived very grandly and gave parties. And I remember in my early childhood, all the servants and the embroidery lady and the zouave, meaning a North African soldier dressed with a pantaloons and a fez, who was there just to make coffee. And I remember the balloon, hot air balloon parties and things that were on a grand scale which have totally disappeared from France.
And that all ended with the German occupation?
It all ended on September 3, 1939. Yeah. My grandfather took me on his knees and he was crying, I could tell. And he said, "My poor children, war has started. War has been declared." And I couldn't understand what all the fuss was about to me in my young mind. It meant putting on a nurse's uniform and taking care of those handsome young men as I used to in the playground. I didn't see I didn't know the drama of it.
You were 8 years old?
Quickly learned, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You had a rather difficult relationship with your parents. Why do you think you...
No,
it was so hard
father.
To gain. Well, your mother seemed to be kind of disapproving and a little distant.
Well, to begin with, my mother had been a dancer on Broadway, and she
was an American.
Yes, she was American, although her name was Petit, and she had danced in the Ziegfeld Follies and several revues, and she was very talented, but she gave it up when she married my father. And frankly, I think she didn't like children. And she had as little to do as possible with us. We had nannies, of course. And she told me early on, "Darling, I know I'm not doing much now, but when you'll be a star, I'll be there."
Did she speak to you in English?
She spoke. No. English was spoken at the table between my father and mother when they didn't want the children to understand. So I did learn a tiny little bit, but I couldn't speak English. And when I came to Hollywood, I really, Gene tells me that I had to learn some of my lines phonetically.
Gene Kelly. So you wound up coming to Hollywood when you were just 20 years old.
A bit younger. I was 18.
Well, you had danced with Roland Petit.
I was dancing with
that
Roland Petit.
That is not related to your mother, even though they
have
the same last name?
No, not a bit. It's a common name. And actually, we had a wonderful time. We used to give 2 seasons in Paris per year. And the rest of the time, we were traveling around to capitals of Europe. We went to Cairo in Egypt and London and Edinburgh Festival, and we had simply a wonderful time, and I thought that was it. That was going to be my life. And then I was given a part where I was the leading lady, and suddenly a lot of filmmakers got very interested and did tests with me, including Rank in England. And everybody turned me down, saying, "What, she looks like a wet rat."
Really?
Or a wet cat.
So Americans thought you were cute, and English
Gene
and French
Kelly,
thought you look like a wet rat?
Yeah. Gene Kelly had a different idea. He'd seen me on the stage, and when he was ready to do an American in Paris, he came to Paris to do a test with me, and the test was accepted, and I was called and told, "You're leaving for Hollywood in 3 days, and that's it."
And you, at that point, you hardly spoke English, you say.
Hardly spoke English.
And you hadn't done any acting.
No, I'd always performed silently. And suddenly, having to speak on that great big movie set with that enormous steel machine in front of me, was rather terrifying.
On the other hand, you could dance, and one of the problems that Gene Kelly complained about and Fred Astaire complained about was that they were often paired with people who couldn't really dance well. Debbie Reynolds talks about crying on the set of Singin' in the Rain because Gene Kelly was so upset with her all the time. Fred Astaire, you tell the story of Fred Astaire talking to you about the problems he had with Ginger Rogers.
Oh, minor problems. It's just that Fred was a bit of a gossip, and he liked to complain, and he was annoyed at Ginger's feathers when she designed that dress with pink feathers, and he said, "Whatever you do, Leslie, no feathers, please," because he said, I have to smile while I'm dancing, and they got into my mouth, they got into my nose. It was horrendous. But also, he was very exacting about finishing shop with the music, and he said that Ginger wobbled once in a while. But I think he was particularly severe. But he was wonderful to work with, and I tried not to wobble.
Still, it had to be slightly intimidating to be dancing with these 2 huge stars and men with whom we associate everything wonderful in movie dancing.
Well, I mean, guess,
were you too young to realize what was going on?
On the one hand, I had the arrogance of the young. And besides, I knew one trick that they didn't know. I could get on my toes, and I could spin on my toes. And so, and already I was a star in the ballet company. That was something quite important. And also, as it had been the war, we hadn't had American films. I had seen Fred Astaire. I had seen one of his films. And my mother used to tell me, "Just watch him because he has fabulous tempo." Of course, I didn't tell Fred. My mother told me. But the first thing they both did when I met them was to show me a montage of all their numbers. And I can tell you, I was really impressed. I thought both of them had done magnificent work. And I came back to the rehearsal hall with Gene, and I said, "Oh, my God, you must have had so much fun." And he said, "Fun? Fun? I can tell you this wasn't fun. It just was a lot of hard work.
You write that during the filming of An American in Paris, you were still so poor that you knitted your own underwear.
Yes, I came with the dress I came with, I had made myself, and the underwear I had knitted. Yes, true.
So you were, you weren't yet being paid the big Hollywood bucks.
My family, having been extremely rich to begin with, during the war, rich or no rich, you just didn't have coupons to buy clothes for growing children. So it's true, I didn't have anything to wear. And the first paycheck was, I believe, $75 a week. And very quickly my mother calculated that what with a meal or two, the night at the Beverly Wiltshire Hotel and a taxi or two, we weren't going to make the week. So she got us up at 6 the next morning and said, quick, let's get out of here. And she found a taxi and said, get us to a cheap hotel. And we landed in a hotel in Culver City, which didn't have too great a reputation. And when Gene Kelly found this out, he yelled on the phone and said, this is where third assistants take the girls during their lunch hour. Margaret, do you want, you know, he said, come over here at once and let me explain a thing or two.
And I hope it gave you a little more money.
No.
Was there a culture shock? There must have been a culture shock. And then your mother left when you were 19, went back to Paris. So you,
yeah,
were you kind of on your own?
I was on my own. And from the bad hotel, we moved on to a motel, which wasn't very much better. But that's all we could afford at first. That's all I could afford. Perhaps a year or two later, I moved on to a little apartment and eventually bought myself a little car.
And then you got married at 21, which is still fairly young.
Yeah.
Hollywood at that time offered a very controlled lifestyle. You say you were censored.
Well, I call it censored, and the MGM called it helped by, you know, a lady from publicity department who really was supposed to translate things I didn't understand, and actually it was censorship. Yes, you had to give the right answers to the questions. They were very controlling. They had to be very careful what the starlets and stars would say, because there was this strong censorship, the Hays office, and they didn't want the stars to say anything that would ruin their box office value.
Although Hollywood was a different kind of town in those days, a kind of small town that...
Yes, it was.
And at 9 o'clock, they rolled up the sidewalks. One of your early movie roles was as Lily Daurier, an orphan who becomes part of a circus act in the film Lily. You probably felt a bit like an orphan yourself at this point.
Yes, and I think that's why I took to the part and took it very seriously. By then, I was taking acting lessons with a Russian teacher called George Darnov, who had learned himself at the Stanislavski School in Moscow.
So you were learning the Stanislavski method
the
in Hollywood?
Method. Yeah, but from
not the Lee Strasberg version.
No, a very authentic version. And so we worked on really making this into a character part. And that wasn't to the taste of MGM, who was used to glamour, glamour, glamour. So at the end of the film, actually, and even during the film, I was strongly advised to put on false lashes, lots of makeup, high heels, and gloss her up. And I said, no, 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 I'm playing an orphan. I can't do that. So they said, orders from above, honey. And I said, who is above? And they said, well, it's the big boss, Dorry Sherry. So I said, I want to go and see Dorry Sherry and explain. So they gave me a car and drove me up to the executive office, and there I was taken from one secretary to the next and moved up to the top office. And finally, Mr. Sherry will see you now. And the door opened, and Doris Sherry stood there beaming with his arms out. "What can I do for you, darling?" And I said, "Oh, Mr. Sherry, I know it's page 36, and I know it should be more glamorous, but I cannot. I'm playing this orphan, you see." And he said, "What film are you in?"
So much for orders from on top. Yeah. Leslie Caron has written a memoir called Thank Heaven. It is published by Viking. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us.
Thank heaven for little girls. Thank heaven for them all, no matter where, no matter who. Without them, what would little boys do? Thank heaven. Thank heaven.
We're back with Leslie Caron, little girl that Marisha Valley was thanking heaven for. In fact, Thank Heaven is the title of her memoir, which has just been published by Viking. There was a little French colony in Hollywood at the time. Did you hang out with Marie Chevalier and Louis Jourdain?
But I hung out with Jean Renoir and his wife Didou.
Well, that's at the top.
Yes.
Jean Renoir, one of the greatest film directors ever.
Ever. And he had built his house on top of Coldwater Canyon, and I think everyone who came from Europe or from New York would come and visit him. And I met many interesting people.
Was he frustrated? He hardly made any films in Hollywood.
He made
The River and...
Yes, and Diary of a Chambermaid, and the film about the recession.
He made some, but
he certainly was frustrated, but as he said, my father was always ahead of his time, and so am I, and that's my fate. And he was very patient with the problems he was having, which were even worse in France. He made a film just before the war in France, and there was a scandal, and the film was slashed into ribbons, and he found it very difficult to work in France as well.
You played an orphan in Lily, and then you played another orphan in Daddy Long Legs, in which you got to dance with Fred Astaire. Was there something about French orphans that appealed to Hollywood screenwriters? In this case, Nora Ephron's parents.
Really?
Yes.
I had no idea.
I just saw, by coincidence, I just watched the film a week ago, and there was the credit for the script. I can't remember their names, but the Ephrons, and I had no idea that you were coming on the show. I enjoyed the film, although it seemed like some of those dance numbers were just shoved in there because they wanted to have more dancing. But the dancing was great.
You're talking about Daddy Long Legs.
Daddy Long Legs.
Well.
Which you look very young, and Fred Astaire looked very old.
Oh, no, but he could dance all right. But I suppose we were doing the third version or something, and I suppose we were the first musical version.
Mm-hmm.
And if it had to do with Fred Astaire, of course, it would have to be a musical.
And now you're dancing with Fred Astaire, and you've already danced with Gene Kelly. That's pretty impressive.
Oh, yes. I was thrilled. I love dancing. But pretty soon I decided I was going to slip back if I stayed into dancing, and I gave up my toe shoes one fine day, because dancing is a profession. I'm talking about classical dancing, mm-hmm. and you can't do two things at the same time.
Well, they put you on point every so often, but you really were not. You were pretty much giving up your ballet technique, weren't you?
Well, no, I was keeping it up And I tried to keep up both. I was taking acting lessons, and I kept taking ballet lessons throughout, and English lessons. And I was just working, working, working. And finally, I found it very conflicting to be an actress and to be a dancer. And so I went to Jean Renoir and asked him what he thought I should do. And he said, well, I don't know if you're a good dancer because I don't know anything about dancing, but I think you're an actress. And he wrote a play for me, which we went to do in Paris. And so I gave up my ballet shoes and tried to concentrate on acting from that moment on.
Well, you've performed in theater in France, but you've never made a French film, have you?
Hardly. I did a little bit of work with René Clair, another grand, grand director. Never fulfilled our desire of doing a film together with Jean Renoir, but I did one with François Truffaut, and that was very thrilling too, and eventually made a film with Louis Malle.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so you worked with some of the greatest directors of all time.
A little bit, yes, but most of my films were in America. Oh, England.
Your first marriage was to to George Hormel of the meatpacking company. You were 21 years old. How did you wind up with a meatpacking guy rather than somebody in the business?
Ah, he had a French mother. This is why, this is how. The French ballet of Roland Petit was in Los Angeles performing, and one of my chums had already met the Hormel family because of the French mother. And so she took me to the house, and there were those three boys, and we all became friends. And within 2 weeks or something, within a month, just like in the movies, I think Geordie said by Wednesday, hey, let's get married on Saturday, and we went off to Las Vegas.
And maybe you shouldn't have.
I shouldn't have, and I called it my baby marriage.
Then your second marriage was to one of the greatest theater directors of all time, Peter Hall.
Peter Hall, yes, and I have my lovely children by him.
Now, why was that marriage a problem for your agents at MCA?
Because it meant living in England and breaking my contract. And so MCA wasn't too happy, neither was my mother. But I was quite willful and decided I wanted to be happy. A career was one thing, but private happiness was more essential. So I broke my contract, and MGM decided on settling with two films. One of them became Gigi, and I was extremely happy to have children in England and be close to that fantastic theatre, the Royal Shakespeare Company. Unfortunately, Peter didn't really want me to be part of the company, and that's what eventually broke up our marriage.
And you were traveling back and forth to do Gigi and the Subterraneans, I guess.
Yes, and many more. I made a film with Henry Fonda, which wasn't too great, but
that must have been fun.
It was wonderful meeting Henry Fonda. And
and working with Cary Grant in another film?
Oh, that was fabulous, yes.
Was he as charming as
he was when he was in a good mood, and he was most often in a good mood. Once in a while, he'd get disturbed if something went wrong. But he was delightful, used to sing Cockney songs. And he told us this most amusing story of his arrival in America and being so poor, he sold ties out of a suitcase on the Broadway sidewalk and looking right and left to see if the heat, as he called it, was coming near, and if he could see a policeman, he'd slam shut the suitcase and run. I mean, that's a vision of Cary Grant that not many people imagine.
Now, what was happening with you? Your marriage broke up with Peter Hall. You had two children. You were going back and forth between Hollywood and Europe. It must have been a rough time.
Actually, I didn't want to admit it at the time, but it started a sort of depression, yeah.
But that, but you did appear in some good film. You were in the L-shaped room.
I know, but I think that anchor that a marriage should be and is had gone, and I... the L-shaped room was during my marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and that was a very great experience.
Well, also, it proved that you really were a fine actor. You won a BAFTA and a Golden Globe.
Nominated for the Oscar as well, yes.
It's claimed that you were the first actress to portray childbirth on the screen. Is that true?
In a more realistic way, I believe so. Somehow, they always showed tough men getting killed and suffering, and bullet wounds were all right. But childbirth had something shocking, and the censorship was very, very prissy about that. And a few sighs here and there, and your belly just got a little bit bigger, but to show it in a realistic dimension was something that had not been done.
They didn't like women to waddle.
What?
They didn't like women to waddle with the big bellies. They had to have a discreet little paunch.
Yes.
One of your chapters is called Life with Warren. Did your relationship with Warren break up your marriage to Peter Hall?
I wouldn't say that.
Warren Beatty.
I would say my marriage was on the rocks because Peter didn't want me in his professional life, and he really wanted me to stop acting, and it was impossible for me. I mean, acting and working was as necessary as my right arm, so the separations were getting worse. And then I met Warren Beatty, and that was my way out of the marriage.
Although you describe him as kind of controlling.
Yes, Warren was very controlling, very loving, but very controlling. Yes, but he was really a very good advice. He was a remarkable actor, would give me acting advice, and he also wanted to perfect everything about me, my hair, my makeup, my clothes, and even my personality. He thought I would be far better off if I went to his shrink and, you know, all that sort of thing. He was like that, but very loving.
After Warren, you filmed Il Padre di Famiglia with Nanni Loy in Italy. Was it shot in the classic Italian way with sound dubbed later?
Yes.
That must have been really odd for you.
It was simply wonderful because I was working, I was playing the mother of three, four, I can't remember how many children. So there were always lots of children on the set with their mothers and little baby sister in their arm and so on. And then there was the lover and the grandfather. And, you know, there were whole families standing by on the set. You could never get silence. And everybody was sort of whispering, but loud whispers, and there was all this wonderful life going on the set, and it was like impressionist background noise, which I loved. And Nanni Loy also had a way of filming where the lights were hidden up above, and the rooms were all open. And you could walk from one room to the other, a bit like on the stage, and there was always a camera to catch you. You didn't have to hit your marks. You didn't have to worry about the lights and the marks and the sound. It was life. We were filming life. And I thought the result was really absolutely wonderful.
But then
I regretted it when he dubbed a clean sound.
Because he had some Italian actress do your voice.
He had an Italian actress do my voice. She was good, but I regretted all this background life.
Now, then you went through a rough patch, and you started writing short stories in the 80s. Had you always wanted to write?
Well, I suppose so. My mother had spent many, many years lying down on her bed and writing. And I suppose I just took over. She never wrote anything that was published, but when I start something, I usually finish it. So I started writing short stories because I was in a really very low period of my life, and I think that saved me.
Well, now you have an inn in Burgundy. At the same time, you're still doing some acting. In fact, you were in a Law and Order SVU where you played a role of the sort you'd never played before, an elderly rape victim. And you just became an American citizen. What's taking you so
yes.
long?
Yes. There was one strike too many in France, and I thought, I've got to try to become an American citizen, and I found out it was very easy because my mother had been born an American.
Leslie Caron will be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 7:30 at the Barnes & Noble store at Lincoln Square, that's on Broadway at 66th Street. The book, her memoir, is called Thank Heaven. It is published by Viking. The website of the inn is The Owl's Nest.
Wait a minute. I've closed it.
Okay, you've closed it.
It's for sale.
Okay. On tomorrow's show, we'll examine the legal and social consequences of the increased reliance on snitching by law enforcement and whether offering deals to criminal offenders in exchange for information is a good idea. Then the life of Lewis Howe, FDR's closest advisor, who helped orchestrate Roosevelt's return to politics after he lost an election and was paralyzed by polio. Then photographer Michael Palizza on his collection of pictures from the North and South Poles. And Three Cups of Tea author Greg Mortensen recounts his ongoing efforts to establish girls' schools in Afghanistan. The Let It Lopez Show is produced by Blake Neeshick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Barbara Kahn, Andrea Maraskin, Stephanie Bernhard, and Sarah Mazel. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Let It Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening.